Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that registrations will be opening very soon for my next 12-week transformation program. Stepping Out from Behind the Smile is an immersive container that guides you through my holistic transformation model, helping you to step off the hamster wheel and start living a life you love. Whether you're looking to address your relationship with food, alcohol, money, or relationships, this program is designed to give you the tools you need to create a meaningful life on purpose. If you're interested in finding out more, you can DM me the word ready, or alternatively, you can contact me through my website and we'll set up a time to connect. It's important I let you know that these groups run at limited numbers. Now, I do this intentionally so that it's an intimate space for you to do the deep inner work. But because of this, spots are limited and the April intake is already filling up. I can't wait to see you inside the container for a life-transforming experience. Now, let me tell you about today's episode. Dialing in from Canada is Nicole Obrigovich. I'm going to be real with you guys. Having been in recovery for over 4 years now, I've heard a lot of stories shared, and not often does someone's story literally stop me in my tracks, but Nicole's did. Nicole is a recovering addict, social justice warrior, and stigma-smashing advocate who's been clean and sober since the 27th of September 2018. Nicole went from being a practicing lawyer with 2 university degrees to dealing meth and being caught up with some seriously dangerous bikie gangs. There was a hit out on her name, but an operation to bring down this bikie gang led to her drug trafficking conviction, and she was sentenced to 3 years in prison. Since then, Nicole has done everything possible to turn her life around, and she now dedicates her days to advocating for women and fighting for change. One thing's for sure, this episode will have you on the edge of your seat. If you love it, please share it and give this podcast a follow. This helps in such a huge way for the podcast to grow and reach more people. And with that, let's kick off this week's episode. Just a note to let you know this episode contains topics that some may find triggering. If you need support, please head to the show notes where you can find a range of mental health support contacts for both Australia and worldwide. Welcome to Behind the Smile with Ash Butters, a podcast designed to reveal the truth behind the masks we wear. Together, we look to demystify the human mind and its behaviours in relation to mental health, trauma, and addiction. My name's Ash, and I'll be your host as we uncover the real stories of people's pain and the steps they've taken to live a life of freedom in recovery. From sobriety to spirituality, join me each week as we uncover the reasons why people seek recovery and how their lives have changed by living one day at a time. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Behind the Smile. Today's guest is Nicole Obrigovich. Nicole is the executive director of the Elizabeth Fry Society of Saskatoon, an organization dedicated to supporting women and gender diverse individuals in conflict with the law. A staunch advocate for social justice, she believes in addressing the root causes of addiction and crime through housing, education, reconciliation, social development, and community support. Nicole's diverse background includes a practice in law and personal experiences with addiction, incarceration for trafficking, and recovery, shaping her into a passionate recovery advocate who openly shares her story to destigmatize addiction, raise awareness, and promote harm reduction, accessible treatment, and sober living options. Nicole's sobriety date is the 27th of September 2018, and she's here today to share her story. Dialing in from across the pond in Canada, I'd love to welcome Nicole onto the show. Nicole, welcome to Behind the Smile. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you, Ash, for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm so looking forward to this conversation. Now, you've had a busy day. You finished speaking, you were telling me before.
Yeah, I do a lot of speaking engagements. And I think that part of it is basically not only to tell my story, but to like you said in the introduction, is to reduce stigma in society. I'm finding that a lot of the work that I do is educating community about how people end up in active addiction, or how people end up homeless, and what we can do as a community to support them to make the changes that they need to make.
Wow, it's incredibly powerful work that you're doing, and I'm really excited to pick your brain on this area a little bit later in this conversation today. So everybody stay tuned for that. But before we dive into that, I would really love for our audience just to get to know you a little bit better, Nicole. So can we kick it off with you sharing, where do you live? What does an average day look like? And what do you do for fun?
I work. No, but I do other things too. As you mentioned, I'm the executive director of the Elizabeth Fry Society of Saskatchewan. And what that organization is, it's an organization basically that supports women that might be in conflict with the justice system or are in conflict with the justice system. We are an organization that's about 14 people, and I feel like most of my days are me trying to hustle money up, because we're a nonprofit organization. And because of the population we serve, which is criminalized women, there's not a lot of empathy in community for women that are in conflict with the justice system. Unfortunately, I think that a lot of people just reduce it to people being bad. And I think that that's also like a common opinion around people that are in active addiction as well. And so, like I said, I feel like a lot of my job is not only hustling money, but also like trying to educate community. And for example, what I just came from was from an organization that's looking to providing housing supports for people that are struggling. And that's the kind of things that we need in community. And we need people to care that there are people living on the street, especially because it's minus 40 here sometimes.
Oh, my goodness. That would just be such tough conditions for people that are out there. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Where did you grow up, Nicole?
Okay. So I'm also from Saskatchewan. I grew up in a small community, about 500 people, seventh generation in Canada. My family is a ranching family, lots of cowboys. There's this really great thing about Saskatchewan. People are, you know, really down to earth and love to help their community, love to help their neighbors. But there's another thing about Saskatchewan that people don't really talk about a lot. There's a really huge drinking culture here. And I'm not really sure if it's because there's not a lot to do here. I'm not really sure if it's because it's winter 6 months of the year. But people just drink. And there's also sort of this attitude that you know, you're not really an alcoholic if you can keep a job. You're not really an alcoholic if you own a business. You're not really an alcoholic if you're driving a $100,000 vehicle. And unfortunately, there is sort of also a culture of normalization. And so people use alcohol to cope. And that's kind of how I grew up as well, just thinking that that was normal. And so, you know, the flags weren't there for me when they should have been. Very supportive family, though. Very supportive family. All the normal things. You know, grew up riding horses and figure skating, and went to university. All those sorts of pieces. So
you're ticking all of life's boxes, doing all of the things that society demanded you do, but then you had this relationship with alcohol that wasn't like other people. I can really relate to it being normalized. Here in Australia, we also have a very heavy drinking culture, and it's more uncommon if you don't drink. And I think sometimes there can be a bit of a peer pressure. I don't know if I personally related to so much to peer pressure. I think I was always going to be an alcoholic. Like from my first drink, I just loved it and I wanted more of it. And, you know, that then followed into drugs and, you know, how the story goes. We all know how the story goes, right?
Yeah.
But how did you find that first experience when you first discovered alcohol?
So I've always had social anxiety, I think, even since I was a kid, and I still have it now, but the difference is now I just like push through. But the first time I actually really got drunk, I was like 12 years old. And me and my cousin, who was like 10 and a half, basically split a 12 pack of beer. And it didn't turn out well. There was a lot of throwing up and, you know, just goofing around or whatever. But you know what? I did. I loved it. I thought that this was the best thing ever. And, you know, I carried that almost instantly into the rest of the summer. Right. And since I had this family where drinking was acceptable, and even, you know, people started early, nobody was really policing what we were doing. So we pretty much spent that whole summer like in different states of drunkenness. So, yeah.
When you say drinking was normalized within your family system, were there any unhealthy patterns of behavior around alcohol, or was that something that just you identify with?
I think that there's absolutely issues around emotional intelligence. Lots of unverbalized expectations, having to walk around on eggshells, you know, drink when you're happy, drink when you're sad, drink when you're mad. If things are going sideways for you, you shove it down and soldier on. That's what you do. You don't talk about your feelings. You just get through it.
And of course, as we know now, the more you do that, the more it just bubbles up inside, and then you need an outlet, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Nicole, I'd love to talk about the photo that you've brought in today. This is a photo from a time in your life where you are hiding behind a smile. So you were presenting one version of yourself to the outside world, but it didn't reflect your internal world, how you were feeling. I'd love for you first to please describe for our audience who may only be listening and not watching this interview today, what does the photo look like? And what was actually going on for you at that time in your life?
I'm actually high in this photo. This is when I relapsed. I had 33 months of sobriety at one point, and I had turned things around in respect to quite a few aspects of my life, and including my relationships with my family and my children. And I started backsliding, and I wasn't telling anybody what was going on. And I ended up in a relationship not much different than the relationship that I was in with my husband. And as a result of the emotional turbulence in that relationship, I relapsed. And I had to pretend that I didn't relapse because I didn't want anyone to know I was high. So I was taking all these cute pictures with him. And that's one of the pictures. So I'm actually high in that picture.
And I could see for you as you paused before started talking that it still brings up a lot of emotion for you looking back at that time.
Yeah, that said, and actually I talked about my relapse today as well because it was difficult, but that relapse put me on the path that I'm on now. And I know that a lot of people in recovery really don't like it when you say that relapse is a part of recovery, because it doesn't have to be. You know, I know a lot of people that it worked the first time. They got it the first time. You know, their program was solid. Whatever they were doing was solid. But that wasn't the case for me. And the reason that is when I first came into recovery, I had just been released from prison. And when I was released from prison, I wasn't transparent about my past. I wasn't transparent about the fact I was in recovery. I wasn't transparent about the fact that I had been to prison because I was still carrying a lot of shame. And I tried to get into a program. I was going to Narcotics Anonymous, and something inside of me was just holding on to that old lifestyle that I was living when I was trafficking drugs. And I started backsliding, and I stopped going to meetings, and I stopped at my step four. And I went down to the States and got into a relationship with somebody that I thought was sober but wasn't. And every character defect that I had came out, and my complete lack of ability to cope in a healthy manner also came out, and I ended up relapsing.
it's so interesting, isn't it? When you look back with hindsight and, you know, you've got sobriety under your belt now, so you can see where it went wrong. But I think in the moment, it's very hard to catch yourself. You know, we say stay in the middle of the bed, do the suggested things, you know, and all of that is said for a reason. But
yeah,
you've got to be willing, you've got to be ready, and something has to click inside, I think, to be able to be open to actually doing the work that will keep you sober.
I think it's also identifying patterns and behaviors, right? One thing that was never really clear to me was the coping mechanism piece. Like I think because drinking was normalized and because that's what I had used to cope in the past and because it didn't work anymore, because, you know, I plateaued on that and that's how I started using drugs. It didn't really occur to me that I was using drugs to mask emotional pain. It didn't really occur to me that my triggers were emotional until far later. And I think it was, you know, when I came back into recovery this last time, I was taking a mental health first aid class. And the woman that was teaching it, she said, your brain cannot differentiate between emotional pain and physical pain. And I was like, what? This now completely makes sense to me. And, you know, I understood being sad or mad or, you know, I understood being disappointed, but I didn't understand that I was using it to cope. And now it just seems like such a no-brainer to me. Mm-hmm. And so I've been able to take that forward with me, and I've been single for the last 5 years.
Great. That's probably a good thing, right? Because, you know, it makes so much sense to me as you describe that, because it does sound really obvious to somebody who was raised in a family system where communication was healthy and these things were spoken about. But I really identify, I grew up in an alcoholic home with a lot of dysfunction, and we weren't able to have these uncomfortable conversations. Like you said, brushed it under the rug. So I become this adult with a really low EQ who is unable to process and feel my own emotions, because since the age of 12, I was 12 as well, I've been using things outside of myself to make me feel better. So makes perfect sense as you share that, Nicole. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'd love for you to help me put together the pieces now, because we, as you mentioned, we jumped forward to the photo, which was this relapse, but you had a big life in between that 12-year-old girl who took her first drink and then that woman who relapsed. So talk to me about the progression of this illness and how it manifested in you from that first drink to then, you know, entering into the world of drugs, trafficking, incarceration, so on and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, the way that I was brought up and the fact that I was from a dysfunctional alcoholic home and my relationship with my parents and my dad especially, I think that that sort of laid the foundation for how my life was going to go. And, you know, and again, it's all in retrospect. But so, like I said, went to university and did all the things. But there was a time where things weren't great for me when I was like in my late teens either. Like there was a lot of drinking and that kind of thing. And my dad introduced me to drugs when I was 15. He introduced me to marijuana. And then when I was 17, he introduced me to cocaine. And I never really grew up with my father. He was around every once in a while. And as far as I was concerned, he was a rock star, because he would only show up on weekends and he would have a bunch of money and, you know, the drinking and the drugs and music and all of this stuff. And so he was really impressive to me when I was a kid. And So I was living on the coast of Canada with him for a little while, and that already was too much for me. And I went back to the middle of Canada, and I ended up in university because I was like, you know, I want to make some changes in my life. And I had my first daughter when I was in university, and then I decided I want to go to law school. So right before law school, I ended up getting married, and I married a guy that I went to high school with that was very much like my father. And I can remember before the wedding, my grandma said, "Are you sure you want to do this?" She's like, "Can't you just live with him?" She said, "He's kind of a good time Charlie." You know, it's kind of funny, but wasn't really funny, because there was absolute glimpses of what my life was going to become before I even married him. Like, he was a weed dealer, and he said that he would quit when we got married because I'm going to law school and you're dealing drugs. And, but you know, I just had this really, we trauma bonded. That's basically it. And, so, you know, all through law school, there was a bit of a, I don't even know how to describe it. There was always some issues going on. Like, he would disappear for days at a time. There was cheating. There was emotional abuse. We ended up having, I had another baby, second year of law school, second term. I took 6 days off and handed in a paper after a C-section. And he took 2 weeks off and then dropped out. He decided to go to school too, but he just wanted student loans. Anyways, so I managed to make it through law school, and then we moved back out to the coast where my dad was. And I had my practice going, and I ended up having another baby, and not an ideal situation because, like I said, there was a lot of emotional abuse going on. But, you know, I didn't really recognize it just because of how I had grown up and what my emotional intelligence was like. I just knew that I really loved this person very, very much. And I, you know, my grandparents had been married 76 years and my other grandparents 60 years. And that's just what you did. You just stayed in the relationship. And so I was trying really hard to make things work, and he wasn't working, and he just wasn't present. And so drinking on weekends, and then drinking Thursdays, and then Thursdays to Mondays, and, you know, just trying to basically deal with how emotionally distraught I felt about the relationship and it falling apart. And then he got in a car accident, and he got a prescription for OxyContin, and he got addicted to OxyContin, and he became physically abusive, and I started using OxyContin also, and cocaine and whatever else I could get my hands on. And I'm still a lawyer, and I'm supporting a family of five, and I can't tell anybody that A, I'm in raging active addiction because I am the only person bringing money home. I can't tell anybody B, that my husband is kicking my ass because I'm a lawyer. And people aren't very empathetic to women that are in abusive relationships. And people aren't really very empathetic to female lawyers at that point either. So there was a lot of pressure on me to just kind of keep things together. And my mental health was suffering very much. And I was working for a firm where I had a fee splitting agreement. And because he wasn't working, you know, I was having problems paying the bills, and I started taking cash under the table from clients, and you cannot do that. And I ended up going from my firm to being a prosecutor so that I could get on salary. And after I switched jobs, my firm found out that I had been doing some shady billing practices, and I was reported to the Law Society, and I had to resign as a prosecutor. So basically at that point, things spiraled completely out of control. I was home all day drinking. He was home all day, and other things were going on as well, like some crime on his end. He had a criminal record before we got married, but, you know, that didn't matter to me. So things just were getting, they were going sideways rather quickly. And I had my Law Society hearing, and I went to the first part of it and I admitted what I did. And then between that part and the part where they actually issued the sanction, my grandfather died. And he had brought me up. I was raised by my grandparents. And so it was like my dad dying, and I was already deep in active addiction. And it just compounded things. And what happened next was I decided that I didn't want to be a lawyer anymore. And, you know, you're programmed so you understand ways and means. And basically, my mind was telling me that I didn't need to be a lawyer anymore because I would be scrutinized. And they were, you know, encouraging that I should go to, you know, AA or NA, or I should be in counseling, or I should go to detox, or whatever. And, you know, I just wasn't interested in that part at that point because I was still trying to keep my marriage together, despite the fact that things were really terrible. I didn't have the money to leave, and I, you know, I loved this person so much. And So after I didn't go to my next hearing part, I got disbarred. And I think that what was really difficult for me was not that, because I was ignoring it. I just didn't go. I wouldn't return my lawyer's calls. I didn't go to the hearing. The actual decision came in the mail. And I think it took me 2 weeks before I even looked at it. And when I did, it said that I was disbarred. And it said that if I would have went to the hearing, I would have only been suspended for a couple weeks. So not in a good headspace. And I then attempted suicide. And my in-laws came in and took my kids. And things just went from bad to worse at that point. So there's lots of crime happening. I started using heroin. He was using heroin. There were, you know, people around the house all the time. There's all sorts of like really low bottom addict kind of behavior, like Home Depot scams, robbing catalytic converters off of vehicles, like the lowest of the low. And so I recognized that it wasn't good. And I was like, okay, I'm going to move back to Saskatchewan where my family is, and I'm going to turn it all around. That's not what happened. I moved back to Saskatchewan and started bringing large quantities of drugs into Saskatchewan from British Columbia. Mm-hmm. And he and I did break up. Because apparently I was a better drug dealer than him and he didn't like that and it got worse. And I got involved with some really, really scary people, and they actually were being watched by the police. And the clubhouse was wired for sound and audio. This is all over the news at this point. And the police came in and busted everybody, and I got arrested for trafficking.
Wow.
Yeah.
My goodness. That is a story, Nicole. Wow. Thank you for sharing. I have to ask, as you were, I really empathize with that version of you that was in that relationship where you so desperately loved somebody. And, you know, we only ever know what we know. We only ever know what we've been taught. And if you didn't have any idea that this wasn't appropriate behavior, like, it would be very hard for you to know at the time, I can actually get myself out of this situation. So I can really understand how it almost just snowballed and things continued to get worse. In regards to the addiction to Oxy,
yeah,
would you describe yourself as being high functioning when you were still working? Like, were you able to get on with things and manage the household?
I wouldn't say manage the household necessarily, and things definitely were unmanageable. In respect to my legal career, like I was a trial lawyer, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to court and I'm high, like I'm high in court. And you know, when it first sort of started going sideways, and it was just kind of, and this sounds horrible, just kind of, it was booze and cocaine. Because I had other lawyer friends that also were doing it. And so it just, again, normalized. I didn't start really with the Oxy piece until I was near being disbarred. I managed to kind of keep it together. And I was high functioning. Like, people didn't know. And if they did know, they definitely weren't sitting down to speak with me about it. And, you know, the firm that I worked for before I went and worked for the Attorney General, you know, I would not show up at work for like a week, and I wouldn't even call anybody. And since I was in a fee splitting agreement, you know, I only took half of what I made home anyways. And, you know, they didn't really care if I was there or wasn't there. Yeah. And so, you know, things were getting filed. You know, I was showing up at court when I was supposed to, but my bills weren't getting paid, you know, like the money that was supposed to be going for rent and for bills and stuff like that, it was going to drugs and booze.
Sorry to interrupt you, Nicole.
That's okay.
I'd love to know, at what point when you decided to start using heroin, do you remember the thought process that went through your mind? Like, did you think, can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So I don't know if anybody who's listening that has done opiates will absolutely understand that thought process, because opiates the opiate addiction is a lot different than an addiction to cocaine or to alcohol in the fact that you are physically addicted. And so OxyContin is one of those things where, you know, it sort of sneaks up on you. I was taking it every day and it was great for numbing things out. So when I was talking about your brain not differentiating, I think that it's a painkiller in every sense of the way. You know, it kills physical pain, but it also kills emotional pain. Like I just, you know, I was numb, completely numb. And by the time that I realized that I was physically addicted to it, it was too late. Like I'd been taking it for about a month and he got cut off of his prescription. And I can remember being sick, like I had the flu, like the worst flu. And I thought I had the flu. And then all of a sudden my brain went, are you dope sick? I think you're dope sick. Because I'd heard about people being dope sick, but I didn't know what that looked like. And so, you know, being cut off the prescription, and at that point in time, because it was around 2008, it was sort of when OxyContin was like a really big thing and people were buying and selling it in North America. And I don't know what it was like in Australia or if it was ever a thing there, but it was such a huge deal in North America. Like you could buy it on the street, but it was expensive. Like one pill was $60, which is, wow, you know, quite a bit of money, right? And I was addicted to the point where I was needing at least one or two a day. And heroin was cheap. You could get heroin for $20, right? And he had already sort of started using heroin behind my back. And I was really, really sick. And I can't remember how it even came up. And he was like, well, just do this. And I was like, no, I'm not fucking doing that. And I was so sick that I did. I ended up doing it because I didn't want to be sick anymore. And the thing is this, when you have an opiate addiction and you are dope sick, if you use, you are not sick in like less than 2 minutes. So, you know, describing that to somebody that doesn't know what an opiate addiction is like, you know, if you have the worst kind of flu you've ever had, you know, diarrhea, throwing up, aches and pains, like all of it, you feel like you're going to die. And somebody says, here, take this pill. It will make you feel better. Of course, you're going to take it. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things had deteriorated so much in my life anyways. Like I wasn't there as a parent. I wasn't there for myself. I wasn't there for anyone. I had alienated myself from everybody that had any sort of semblance of normality in my life that, you know, I just wanted to feel okay. And it was that way, not only with the drugs, but in the relationship and everything else. I just wanted to feel like everything would be okay. Mm. And that's the only time I felt like that was when I was high.
And so I imagine you almost would have become addicted to the feeling as well as being physically addicted, like wanting to stay in that bubble of everything's going to be okay. And then at what point did you make that internal decision that I'll do whatever it takes to keep driving this train, to keep running and living this life? Like how did you fall into the criminal activity?
So I don't think that that's ever just a choice. I think it just happens because again, ways and means, right? Mm. When you're in that sort of state in your head, you are driven by, you know, I always talk about it as a circular sort of nightmare because it's getting the money to get the drugs, getting the drugs, doing the drugs, getting the money to get the drugs, doing the drugs, or getting the drugs, doing the drugs. And as soon as you've done the drugs, you're already thinking about how you're going to get drugs again. And, you know, I think that with opiates, it's far worse than other drugs. I think that, you know, and by the way, I moved on from opiates. I managed to wean myself off with methamphetamine, which, you know, just as bad, worse. But I wasn't physically addicted. And I can tell you that there's a difference. There's absolutely a difference. And so when you know you're going to be so sick that you're going to die, you'll pretty much do anything to make sure that you're not going to be sick. And that's how the criminal behavior started. And then, you know, there's survival dealing so that you have your substance. And then there's dealing for profit. And I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but because I'm a little intelligent, that was just the natural progression, right? And I knew a lot of people I knew a lot of people, and I knew people in the middle of Canada, and I knew people on the coast of Canada, and I knew people that would provide me with large amounts. And so what's better for an addict, a small amount or a large amount? So that's it just was like a natural progression. I think that, you know, we talk about, you know, low bottom addict, high bottom addict, that kind of thing. And there's another term that's used a lot in that lifestyle, and it's dope simple. There's people that are only focused on the drugs, and that's all you think about all the time. But then there's other people that think about how you can use that to capitalize to make sure that you have so many drugs that you're never going to run out. And I was one of those people.
Wow. Oh, tell me about that day when the police came and you were arrested. What was that like?
So I kind of talked a little bit about ending up working for a rather large criminal organization. And it wasn't easy to get out of that lifestyle because of that. When I first started working for them, it was actually as a result of me, there's somebody, they made an attempt on my life, some other people that I had been working with. They kicked my hotel door in and tried to murder me with a golf club, and I wouldn't tell the police what had happened. And so there was sort of this, I had this reputation in community that, you know, I was solid and I wouldn't say anything. And so I started working for these other guys, but I didn't understand that the vice president of this bike club had actually gotten the clubhouse wired with cameras and audio and everything else. And as a result of that relationship, that's how I ended up getting arrested. But it wasn't like I just got arrested and then I went to prison. What happened was I got arrested and then I got released on bail because I didn't have a criminal record. And so there was like a period of time, about 6 to 8 months, where I was arrested multiple times. And the last time that I got out, I had conditions and I was on really strict bail. And I can remember that day because I was so tired of the lifestyle. And I wanted out, and I didn't know how to get out because the people that I was working for, I owed money to. And when I got busted, I owed them a large amount of money and they were letting me work it off. And in the meantime, I ended up working for a different street gang and I owed them money. And so it wasn't so simple that I could just go, okay, well, I'm quitting. And I was frantically in my bedroom packing suitcases because in my mind, and I was high, I was like, I'm just going to move. I'm going to move to another city and I'll be able to get away from this and I'll quit drugs and everything like that. And then there was a knock on my door and I was like, it's the police. It's the police. And I'm like, I'm not going to any other city. And I sort of stopped myself and I went, you know what? Let's do this. Let's just get this done with. Like I've been thinking that maybe I could get off somehow, you know, maybe I wouldn't have to go to prison. And I just went outside and I said, let's do this because I didn't want to live like that anymore, you know? And so that day probably saved my life.
Yeah. I was there a sense of relief in a way that you could stop running or that? Yeah,
absolutely. There was absolutely a sense of relief. Yeah. Yeah.
How long were you in prison for, Nicole?
So I received a sentence of 3.5 years, and I actually ended up doing only 9.5 months because in Canada, you're eligible for parole at 25% of your sentence. And because I didn't have a criminal record previous to this, I was a good candidate for parole. And they actually sent me to treatment when I was in prison. So, wow. Yeah, I know. I was pretty lucky. I ended up doing a 6-week treatment program outside of the prison. And when I got sent back just to finish my time, then I got out of parole at that point. So I only did 9 months of my 3.5 year sentence. I did 21 months in community, but I mean, that's in community.
And so
a lot different.
Very different. Absolutely. So Nicole, how did you turn your life around from that woman who was in jail, incarcerated, going through a rehabilitation program to where you are now advocating for women and the incredible work that you do with 5 years sobriety, like, help me put the pieces together, because that's okay. Phenomenal.
And this is absolutely the best part of my story. And I think that I only tell those other pieces because I want people to understand that it can be bad. It can be really bad. And you can turn things around. I mean, it doesn't have to be the end of the road. And so, like I said, I got released and I was on parole. And I think that was good because, you know, I was kind of working a program and there was some oversight. I had to do your analysis all the time. And that kind of gave me time and space to kind of know what recovery looked like. Even though I did backslide and I did end up relapsing, like we talked about, that relapse scared the crap out of me. Like, I couldn't believe how quickly it progressed. Like, it was like, I think it was only 10 days in and I'd lost 25 pounds and I was in psychosis and it was all really bad. And it was at that point that I knew that was not what I wanted. I was miserable. And I was like, this is not what I want for myself. This is not what I want my life to look like. And so I reached out to somebody that I knew from Narcotics Anonymous and I was like, can you sponsor me? I need somebody to sponsor me. And she, at that point, I think she had 10 years at that point. And she said, come back to BC. And I moved back to British Columbia and I had nothing, again, starting from scratch, from nothing. And I started going to meetings and I started working my steps and I started taking suggestions. And I drank the Kool-Aid. And I think that Narcotics Anonymous absolutely saved my life. Doing the steps, it was absolutely life-changing. But at the same time, I was also like really driven by the thought that I needed to learn to let go of that shame, like right off the hop. Even without the work of my program, I realized that was part of the reason that I relapsed. The fact that I wasn't able to be transparent about my recovery and the fact that I wasn't able to be transparent about the fact that I had been to prison, I'm pretty sure that that's what led me back out. And so I was like, I think I was only at about 6 months clean. And I just decided one day that I was just going to tell everybody. I was telling everybody about it. I'm like, you know, telling everybody I'm in recovery, telling everybody that I've been to prison and, you know, just sort of discussing my story, which was like sort of a big deal because I had been a lawyer, right? And when people think about, and we kind of talked about this already, when people think about drug addicts or they think about alcoholics, they're thinking about people that are living outside or behind the garbage can or, you know, the dirty person that you don't make eye contact with. But that's not it at all. It can happen to anybody. And so I think at the beginning that was sort of my message. It can happen to anybody. And it also occurred to me at that point that coming from a place of privilege, being a white woman, because there's a really high population of Indigenous people in the carceral system here because of colonialism. And, you know, it occurred to me, it was so difficult for me when I got out, and I have 2 university degrees, and I have, you know, despite what's going on with my family, I have a supportive family and have people that love me, and I don't have the same type of trauma that these women have. And it just occurred to me that I could take my formal education and my lived experience and do something with it. And be really vocal and start lobbying different stakeholders and community and government and that kind of thing. And so I started doing a lot of public speaking, and I ended up like starting to do presentations at the law school. There's like newspaper interviews. There was like me doing radio interviews. And like, at first I was like really nervous. And then I was like, no. You need to do this because you need to educate people in respect to their feelings around stigmatizing people in recovery, because that's the exact opposite of what people that are trying to recover need. And so I ended up getting a job with an organization very similar to the one I work for now, same name actually. And So I worked for them for 4 years, and then an opportunity came open in the province that I grew up in and the province I got arrested in to come back as an executive director to support women that are incarcerated. And it was full circle. And this work is very personal to me and very meaningful. And every day, I think I get to change at least one or two people's minds about their attitudes, about people that are ending up in a carceral system or ending up in active addiction or ending up in a situation where they're not easily able to leave their partner. And I talk about it every opportunity that I get. And now I'm actually even able to develop programming to support people. And that's life-changing.
That's incredible, Nicole. It truly is a full circle moment. And the fact that you're able to be in this position of a lived experience, like you just apply a completely different lens to the problem. And I think that that will give you a lot of strength and power in the way that you can influence. And like you said, even if it's just changing one or two people's minds each day, like there's so much power in that. Now, one of the topics that you're really passionate advocating for is to remove the stigma around intimate partner violence. Now, this is a huge, huge problem in Australia. I'm not sure what the stats are in Canada, but as we conduct this interview today, we've lost 71 women this year in Australia to domestic violence. Why do you think it is so difficult for victims to leave these environments?
I think resources, number one, you know, and this is something that I didn't really touch on. But like I said, he wasn't working. So I was responsible for bringing money home. But it wasn't like, you know, I had control of that money at all. And there was never enough money to actually leave. I think that there's a lot of nuances to it as well. You know, like I said, I was absolutely in love with this person. I had children with this person. I didn't have the resources to leave. I couldn't reach out to, you know, my family who did not like him and would have been like, well, we told you, you know, so you don't want to deal with it that way. I didn't want to tell people at work because I was embarrassed. I'm a lawyer, you know, and people get in that situation. And then there's also, if you think about it, generational trauma. If you grow up in an environment where violence is normal, you know, it has to get really bad before you'll leave. And often the police aren't helpful. The police aren't helpful at all. You know, he got charged more than one occasion. And in Canada, if the police come out to a domestic violence call, they are supposed to lay charges no matter what. That's not what really happens. One time the police showed up, we were living in a hotel, and he had choke marks, black eye, my stuff was all in the parking lot. And the only reason the cops were there is because somebody had committed suicide two doors down. And I was trying to get my stuff, and the police officer went in and got a suitcase for me so I could put my stuff in it. And I said to him, I'm like, aren't you supposed to charge him? And he said, I got you a suitcase, princess. Isn't that enough? And let's throw some racism in there, because in Canada, and especially Saskatchewan, where I'm living right now, there is a lot of racism. And unfortunately, there's a lot of Indigenous women in our province that are not getting the supports that they need for that reason.
Mm-hmm. I've heard Dr. Gabor Maté talk about this a lot, and it's just devastating, the racism and that, and like you said, that generational trauma and colonialism, which is just has this ripple effect which you see in the prison system today.
I'm gonna give you one quick one,
please.
So the provincial jail in Saskatchewan has space for 166 women. In the summer, there was 273 women incarcerated in that jail. 95% are Indigenous.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
How do we fix this? Where does one start? Yeah, I bet you do.
I have some ideas, yeah. So I've been pushing the government quite a bit since I got here, and it's really weird for me because I'm getting into rooms that I think that are difficult for a lot of people to get into. And I feel like despite the fact that our government is somewhat conservative, that they're actually listening to me because we're at a tipping point. You know, when we're talking about, you know, an institution having an extra 100 women in it and they're double bunking segregation and secured and that sort of thing, something has to be done. And so I've got some proposals that I'm making around holistic, basically holistic supportive housing, where people can be housed either after charge, they can get out on bail and get the supports that they need around addiction and trauma, and also cultural programming as well. And not only that, but reintegration as well, because we have huge homelessness issues here as well. And the stats are that 65% of women were couch surfing before their arrest. And in a provincial institution, when you get released, they release you to the street. So that means that most of the women that are being released are going to be engaging in the same behavior they were engaging in before they went in. And that, circling back to the domestic violence issue, if the only place you can be released to is a home where that's the kind of treatment that you are receiving, you're going to still go, because what's worse, living there or being incarcerated? And that's what we're looking at. So much violence.
It's such an impossible situation. And then as we were just talking, the other thing that I was thinking about is we already have the stigma as an addict, right? So if you're then using alcohol or drugs to cope with this toxic environment, and then you're in a domestic violence situation, the assumption is going to be, well, you've chosen this life. You chose to do drugs. You chose to get into this relationship when, like you said earlier, none of this is actually a choice.
No. I've been saying this quite a bit lately, and I'm going to say it again. I think that we're only as good as our options. You know, you could talk about choice all day long, but if you don't have any options, there is no choice. You don't have a choice. So I think as human beings, we do what we have to do to survive. That is, you know, a biological imperative. We have to survive, right? And so whether it's using drugs and alcohol to try to cope emotionally, or whether it's engaging in crime so that you can, you know, use drugs, or you can eat, or you can do whatever you feel like you need to do, that's all pieces of that. And, you know, when we think about survival, you know, people are always just thinking about, you know, housing and food and that's that sort of thing. But sometimes your reality is so ugly that you need drugs and alcohol to cope. And I get that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Nicole, I want to circle back to something that you said at the beginning of this conversation, because even just speaking to you throughout the last 50 minutes or so, I can see the amount of growth and the work that you've done on yourself as a result of your sobriety, which is amazing. You mentioned that you've been single for the last 5 years. And I'd love to know, with all of the experience that you've had, particularly with domestic violence and the abusive relationships and toxic relationships, what has driven that decision, and what have you learned about yourself in this time?
You know, I don't necessarily think it was so much of a decision as it just like, so like I said, the relapse was connected to a relationship, and I still talk to him. He's in prison. We're still friends, you know, whatever. And I still care about him. But I have a whole different understanding about the boundaries that I need to have in my life to protect myself. And it's not that like I haven't, you know, dated or, you know, played with the idea of being in a relationship or whatever, but I can tell you that I've got zero chip. I don't have time for any bullshit at all.
Yeah.
I'm quite happy by myself. I have purpose in my work. You know, I've got my kids, and you know, sometimes I was on holidays and I'm like, oh, it'd be so great to have a boyfriend once in a while to go on a holiday with. But I also don't want my peace of mind affected. And that's priority for me. you know, working a set of steps and having a program and, you know, knowing what my worth is. I'm not compromising on that. I think that eventually, and it's not forever. I think that eventually I'll probably meet somebody that I'll feel safe with, or that I'll feel like I can give that a try. But I'm not compromising my peace of mind. I'm not compromising my sobriety, and I'm just not compromising what I've built. And I continue to build every day because my life is more about more than just my, you know, myself and my job. It's about giving back to community as well. And it's really important to me that that I take care of myself. Let's just put it that way. And
I love that.
Yeah. And I think that there are a lot of people in this world that don't understand what my expectations would be around that. And I'll wait.
I love that. Later, we'll love
somebody
that.
Maybe.
Nicole, tell me, how have you healed the relationship with your children?
Yeah, that was kind of difficult, right? Because, when the last few years that I was in active addiction, I alienated myself from absolutely everybody. Like, I didn't talk to my mom. I didn't talk to the kids. I didn't talk to anybody in my family. And, you know, I tried to maintain a relationship with my children, but every time I get on the phone with them, I cry. And like that, you know, it was really hard. And so when I got arrested and I kind of came out of the fog, I used to go to the gym in prison and I would get on the treadmill and I would cry because I was just so sad. I was like, you know, you were a lawyer. You're now on the treadmill in prison crying because you burned your whole life down. And I kind of did this weird thing where I got introduced to the 12 steps and I took a look at the literature and I kind of like sort of picked and choosed what I wanted to do out of it because there was no sponsor in there. So I was like, step eight, let's do a step eight. So I started writing some letters, right? I wrote letters to the really obvious people in my life that I needed to reach out to because, you know, I do have a lot of really great supports and I do have a lot of people that really care about me and love me. And I have a lot of people that I hurt. And so I started writing these letters and, you know, it was great because people were receptive. They were really receptive. And my children, not so much at the beginning, right? So,
of course.
I sort of made a promise to myself just to be as consistent as I could be. And so I would send a letter once a month. And then I also was very careful. My oldest daughter, she saw a lot of what was going on. Like she was 18 when she finally moved out, but like she saw a lot of things that she shouldn't have. And so I wrote her one letter and I left it at that. And then my two younger kids, I started writing once a month and then I started calling every Sunday. And it took 3 months before my daughter would speak to me. My son came back pretty quickly, a little bit of tears and that kind of thing. But every Sunday I will call. And she finally did start talking to me again. And when she was 18, she moved in with me. And when my son turned 18, he moved in with me. And all my relationships are great with my children. I'm very grateful for that because I know that a lot of people don't get that second chance.
Yeah, that's absolutely beautiful and such a testament to your recovery and where you are today. I'd love to know, Nicole, what do you do for your recovery today? How does it look compared to 5 years ago? Because I imagine it's evolved.
Oh, it has. unfortunately, I feel like I'm one of those people that, you know, you go hard with program when you first go. And
oh yeah,
I was definitely one of those people, except for in respect to my step work. It took me 4 years to get through a set of steps. 4 years. And it was kind of a joke. It was a joke between my sponsor and I because I was always like, I'm marinating. And that said, I was very, very thorough. I was very thorough. I wrote a lot. And when we would have to go through my step work, like it would be two or three times. It wasn't just one time. And I got a lot out of it. Like I really did. And I absolutely live my program. I have a sponsee right now, although I haven't talked to her for a little while. I don't know what's going on. But coming back to Saskatchewan was kind of difficult for me because when I came into recovery, I was in a community. I'd never used it. I didn't use with anybody in that community. Everybody I was in the rooms with had never seen me. Hi, they didn't know what was going on. And listen, I was terrible when I was a drug dealer. Like I was not a nice person. And, so coming back to the community I got arrested in, and I went to an NA convention, it was so bad. There was like eight people that I either sold drugs to or that owed me money or that I had beef with. And I was trying to smooth it over. It was so weird. And so now being in the community that I did use in, I am exposed to some people that there's some people that still are using and that sort of thing. And I haven't been really going to meetings. I do talk to my sponsor all the time. Like I said, I do a sponsee, and I think that in respect to program, my work, like there's so much around addiction and that kind of keeps my finger on the pulse. And even though I'm getting paid, it's service. It really is service.
Yeah. And I talk in a way you're living in step 12. Like,
yeah,
there's a message that you're carrying, and there's absolutely, you're giving back to the community every single day, which is amazing.
Yeah. I do need to go to more meetings.
Yeah. You know what? I describe it as when I go to a meeting, I feel like I'm plugging myself back into the energy source. And so it just gives me that connection. Yeah. And then, you know, I'll go through a period where maybe I'm not going to as many, and I'll start to feel a little bit not ever tempted to drink or use again. It's not about that, but I just kind of, my sponsor describes it as, you know, we fall off the beam a little bit. And so you just like get yourself back on and you know, run to full capacity, which is nice. Nicole, there's one final question that I love to ask all of my guests as we near the end of the show today. So I'm going to ask that one for you now. The question is, what are your three non-negotiables that allow you to live your life today happy, joyous, and free?
Oh, three non-negotiables. I think I kind of touched on this one already. Anything that screws with my peace of mind that isn't something that's close to my heart has to go. Absolutely. Having purpose is something that is non-negotiable. I recently got offered a job for more money and I turned it down because it doesn't give me purpose. It doesn't speak to my heart. Surrender. Surrender. I have learned to live in faith. And that is everything to me. It's absolutely everything to me. And I think that when people finally understand what even that means, and the first time around, I didn't get that piece. And now I live in that. And I think that, for sure.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing. And Nicole, thank you for your time today. I've honestly loved this conversation. I'm so inspired by the work that you do and everything you do to give back. We say here on Behind the Smile that when we recover loudly, no one needs to suffer in silence. So you are absolutely doing your part, and I can't thank you enough for your time.
Thank you, Ash.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah, you too. Okay, bye.
A big thank you for tuning in today. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by hitting the follow button and leaving a rating and review. Each rating and review helps this podcast become more discoverable so more people can hear these stories of strength and hope. Together, we will continue to remove the stigma around mental health, trauma, and addiction. Remember to reach out to those you care about, and I'll be back next week. Until then.